This year, I had a sort of rabbinic bonanza because I learned two new Yom Kippur jokes, thereby doubling my repertoire, one of which you will hear tonight, and one you will hear tomorrow. And each of them actually has a point, which is even better. The rabbi walks outside on Yom Kippur to catch a breath of fresh air. And outside, he sees Irving eating a ham sandwich. So he says to him, "Irving, did you forget it was Yom Kippur?" He goes, "No, I remember." He said, "Well, did you forget that you're not allowed to eat on Yom Kippur?" He goes, "No, I remember that too." He said, "Well, did you forget that even if you're going to eat on Yom Kippur, you shouldn't eat a ham sandwich because it's not kosher?" He goes, "No, I actually remember that also." And the rabbi, sputtering, says, "Well, what did you forget?" Irving thinks for a minute. He goes, "I forgot I was Jewish." Now, there is a point to this. This town is filled with Jews who much of the time effectively forget that they're Jewish. It's not that they literally forget, but in their attitudes and in their lives and in their way of thinking about themselves, they forget. And this year, for the first time in many years, I need to boil down in some ways what it means to be Jewish, because starting actually the day after tomorrow, I'm teaching Introduction to Judaism to students at UCLA. And I did this many years ago at Hunter College. And I've taught other subjects at UCLA before, but not Introduction to Judaism, which makes you distill what it is you think about a vast and complicated tradition. And one of the things that I know, in part there'll be Jewish and non-Jewish students there, is that for Jews, it is not always easy. There's a beautiful story about the Maggid of Jerusalem, Rabbi Schwadron, who had the same problem that we have every now and then, which is one of his students came to him and said, "I'm sorry, I can't be in class on Monday because I have soccer finals." So the rabbi said to him, "Well, explain this game, soccer." So the student explains it to him, tells him what it is, and the rabbi goes, "Well, I don't see the problem. Go right now, take the ball, kick it into the goal. You'll be done. You'll come back on Monday and study." So the student says, "Rabbi, you don't get it. The whole point is there has to be a goalie to make it difficult. If it's not difficult, there's no point to it." And the rabbi said, "That's exactly my point. Come Monday." I'm not saying that it's easy to express your Judaism. But part of expressing it, of course, is knowing what it is. And so I thought that for Yom Kippur, I would use you as a little bit of an experiment and hang Judaism on one particular character, because later this year, in the spring, I have a few months sabbatical where I'm going to be taking off time from the synagogue to write a book. And what happened was Yale University Press is doing a series of Jewish lives, and they called me and they said, "We'd like you to do a Jewish life. Moses is taken." So you can pick anyone you want, but you can't take Moses because already assigned. So I took David, not only for the obvious reasons, but also because there's more ink given to David in the Torah than anyone else. We're studying David in the Torah class this year. We started last year. And I thought, what is it about this character that illuminates what Judaism really is? And the first thing that David tells us is the way in which Jews see human nature. We don't see people as fundamentally, basically good, nor do we see them as fundamentally bad. We see everybody as engaged in a constant either struggle or at least balance between goodness and impulses that are not so good. David is a very good example. You may have in your mind some vague idea that he did something wrong with Bathsheba. Let me just give you in a minute what it was that he did. It wasn't just that he saw her from the rooftop of the palace where she was bathing nude in the adjoining building on the roof, and why she was doing that is a separate question. This is not a sermon about Bathsheba. But and he brings her to the palace and he sleeps with her and then discovers that she's pregnant. And the problem is, of course, she's got a husband whose name is Uriah, who is a Hittite. In other words, not a native-born Israelite, but he's fighting with the armies of Israel. So what David does is he figures he's got to get Uriah home and he's got to get him to sleep with his wife so no one will know that the child is David's. So he brings him home, because after all, he's the king. He can bring a soldier home. And he says to him, Uriah, go home. And Uriah says to him, I would never go home. Not right now, not when your majesty's forces are fighting at the front. How could I go home? I couldn't do that in good conscience. Just David's luck. He found the one honest soldier in the army. He won't go home and sleep with his wife, so he gets him drunk. And even so, Uriah won't go home. And you see the contrast between how honest and decent Uriah is and how not is the king of Israel. And Uriah goes back to the front, and then David says to Joab, to his general, put him in the front lines so he is killed. And he does. And he is. Now, there is more to the story. What happens then, of course, is the prophet Nathan comes to David and says, there was a man who had lots and lots of sheep, and a poor man who had one, and the rich man took the sheep of the poor man. What should happen to him? And David says, that he should never do that. He should die. And Nathan says to him, you're the man. But here's where you see the complexity of Judaism's view. Because in most ancient cultures, what would the king do with a prophet who had the goods on him? The same thing he did to Uriah. He'd kill the prophet. But David does tshuva. He does repentance. He begs God's forgiveness. He suffers. His child dies. And you see why we're here. Because Judaism believes that people struggle and they sin, but also that they can repent and they can overcome and they can become good again. And they have to give each other the opportunity to do that, as Nathan did to David. And remarkably enough, as you know, it is the second child of David and Bathsheba, whose name is Solomon, who becomes the next king of Israel. So the first thing to realize is that both greatness and darkness exist in every human soul, and that's how we see people. And that's one of the reasons that you will not find a perfect character, not in the Bible, not in the Talmud, nowhere in the Jewish tradition. And that's the reason that we believe that human beings need each other. The very first statement about human nature in the Bible is Lo tov heyot adam levado. It's not good for a human being to be alone. You have to have family, friends, community, others. And we as a Jewish community, we believe this and we practice this. As I said, the first night of Rosh Hashanah, Rosh Hashanah Live, I remember when the Soviet Union was persecuting every religion, and they persecuted Christians, they persecuted others. There was only one religion that had a worldwide movement to free its compatriots. And that was the Jewish people, because we believe in those familial bonds, in taking care of one another, that we are bound each to each, that we go through the desert holding hands. I heard a beautiful African proverb If you want to travel fast, travel alone. If you want to travel far, travel together. We have traveled very far. And we really do believe in traveling together because none of us is perfect, so none of us can do it alone. But we don't only care about ourselves. When David's son Solomon built the temple, he imported goods from all over the world because he had diplomatic relations with all the nations around him. From the house of David comes the Messiah, and as I mentioned just before, when the Messiah comes, all the world is redeemed, not only the Jewish people. We really do believe that we're here for everyone. Remember that Rosh Hashanah is not the beginning of the Jewish people, it's the beginning of the world. That the start of the Bible isn't with Abraham and the founding of the Jewish people, it's with Adam and Eve and the founding of humanity. The greatest single statement the Jews made to the world is that every human being is B'Tselem Elohim, in the image of God. That is the foundation of our belief. And the fact that some don't live up to it yet just reinforces how far we have to go. And once you know what people are like and what they are supposed to be like, then you have to remember that the greatest declaration that the Torah made to the ancient world is that we are not alone. It's not good for human beings to be alone, and each human being is never alone. We believe in something greater than ourselves. And there are two major implications to the idea of God in this world, however you conceive of God, and believe me, any idea you can have of God, you can find some Jewish philosopher, renegade or mainstream, who had just as abstract, crazy, personal, impersonal idea as you. We have been through it all. But all of them essentially came down to two major things, and the one is that the world is shot through with radiance, that it is miraculous, it is beautiful, that there is a magic to being alive because we are more than just stuff. Because in addition to synapses, we have souls. Because, as the prayer says, Al nisecha shebechol yom imanu, we really do see miracles every day, all the time. In things that are simple and things that are complex. And the second is that we have responsibilities in this world. That we have obligations. That the anguish that we feel and the blessings that we have, these are part of the sense that we are all part of a bigger project. I've talked before about that wonderful concept by the philosopher Derek Parfit. He talks about something called the bias of the near. The bias of the near means you pay much more attention to things that are close. So, for example, if I tell you tomorrow night I want you to do something you don't want to do, you'll say no. But if I say you'll do it next year, you'll go, okay, it's next year. And the same thing he points out that we do with time, we do with space. If you saw a child next to you was starving, you'd feed him right away. If it's happening across the world, you forget about it. Same child. Same starving, but it's far away, and we have a bias towards the near. That's why Judaism insists again and again and again that one God creates the world, that all human beings are alike, because we believe that everything is tied together. We make the world close. After all, we've been everywhere. There isn't a place you can walk that you won't find Jews. This year, July 1st, we'll be taking a trip to Spain and to Israel. Why are we going to Spain? We're going in the footsteps of the Jews. But you could have picked any country. Because the truth is, we have left footsteps everywhere in the world, because for us, it's all close. It's all God's world. So it's all our responsibility. That's also what it means to be Jewish, and it's one of the things that makes it hard, but also makes it beautiful. And then lastly, we're a learning people. We study. We learn. We're called the people of the book, but actually we're the people of many books. You know, the first commandment in the Torah is be fruitful and multiply. And you know what? The Torah did that. It became lots and lots and lots and lots of books. And here too, David provides a model. Not only because David was a poet, he wrote psalms, as well as a king, but because there's this beautiful midrash, this beautiful rabbinic tale that David once turned to God and said, "Tell me the day on which I'm going to die." And God said, "No one is allowed to know that. But I will tell you this, David, it will be a Shabbat. You will pass from this world on a Shabbat." So every Shabbat, what did David do? He studied. And as long as he was studying, the angel of death couldn't get near him. One day, the angel of death arranged a distraction. David stopped studying for a minute, and he died. Now, what's the idea behind that? Did the rabbis really think that no one dies when they're studying? Of course not. But David represents the Jewish people, and what they're saying is, as long as the Jewish people continue to learn, they will not die. So do you know more than you did last year? Did you study something, learn something? Did you overcome that obstacle? Because that's also part of what it means to be a Jew. Do you know what the very last commandment is, the 613th? It's to write a Torah scroll. What other tradition, which not only conceives of God as studying, because after all, the rabbis assume God studies Torah like everybody else, what tradition do you know of that commands you to write a book? So I'm thinking, all of these elements, how do you combine them? And then I remembered a story that I had read years ago and I had never told. And I realized that anybody who has a Jewish neshama, a Jewish soul, will understand this story, that it unfolds endlessly, endlessly. It's a story that really is very simple but can last you a lifetime. It's about a man whose real name was Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, but everyone called him the Chofetz Chaim, the one who desires life, because he wrote books about proper speech and improper speech, and he was the most famous rabbi at the end of the 19th and the early 20th century. But the interesting thing about him was that to meet him, you wouldn't know that. He was very short. He lived in a very small town. He was very soft-spoken. He just happened to be a genius of tremendous character and insight. I'll tell you one story before I tell you the story, just so you'll know what kind of person we're dealing with here. In fact, I could tell you two stories before the story. If you've got time, if you're not going anywhere, let me just tell you two. They're very quick stories, I promise. And then I'll get to the story that I really want to tell. Here's what the Chofetz Chaim was like. Okay? He's worth knowing about. Trust me on this one. The Chofetz Chaim was the guy who once a delegation of tourists from America went to visit him in Radom, in his little town. And they found the Chofetz Chaim in his study with a rickety desk and a few books. And one of them said to him, "Where's all your stuff, Rabbi?" And he said, "Where's yours?" And they said, "We're just passing through." He said, "Me too." Okay, that's what he was like. Once the Chofetz Chaim, in fact, was testified, this is a beautiful story, he testified in a trial, and the lawyer said to the judge, this was in a Polish court, the lawyer said to the judge, "Listen, the rabbi who's about to testify is this great, famous, world-renowned rabbi. Let me just tell you one story about him, judge, so you'll understand who it is you're dealing with. Once in the middle of the night, A thief broke into the Chofetz Chaim's house and took all the silver and ran down the street. And the Chofetz Chaim ran after him saying, I declare that silver hefker, which means ownerless. In other words, he no longer is a thief. Since it's ownerless, he was allowed to take it. And that prevented him from being a thief. So the judge says to the lawyer, let me ask you a question. Do you really believe that story happened? Do you really believe this rabbi ran out in the street after somebody and said, you can take my silver? And the lawyer said, you know, Your Honor, I don't know. But one thing I do know, they don't tell stories like that about you or me. Okay? That's the Chofetz Chaim. So several years ago, I read about somebody who grew up in his yeshiva and fell away from Judaism and then returned to the tradition. And when someone asked him why he returned to the tradition, he told the following story. He said, you know, when I was young, I was very rebellious. And even though, like everybody, I revered the Chofetz Chaim, I was through with Judaism and through with study, and I left the yeshiva. And one day, I was standing on a street corner, and it was Shabbat. And I was smoking a cigarette, and who should walk up but the Chofetz Chaim? And I thought, oh my God, I can't believe I got caught smoking a cigarette on Shabbat by the Chofetz Chaim of all people. So immediately I throw down the cigarette and I grind it out, and he looks at me and he starts walking up to me, and I think he's going to scream at me, he's going to yell at me, he's going to tell me about my parents. He said, and he walked up to me and I looked down at him because he was short, he was 5 feet tall. And he looked up at me and there were tears in his eyes. And he said to me, Shabbos, Shabbos. And that was all he said. He said, you know, that voice and those eyes followed me the rest of my life. And what I want to say to you is Jewish. Don't be afraid of it. Don't put it aside. Don't ignore it because it's inconvenient or embarrassing. Think of those eyes. And think of the depths of history and wisdom and insight and meaning that's carried in that simple word. Not because we're better. That's a foolish, fleeting, and hollow rationale. Not because we have this or that political position. And not because we're old. Longevity alone means nothing. But because it's who we are. We're an ancient, struggling, learning, sacred, contributing, giving, passionate people. Don't give that up when you walk out of the synagogue. Don't forget those eyes when you go to work, when you raise your children and your grandchildren. We are a small people, but we carry a vital message to the world. Jewish. It says something about us, about God, about history, and about destiny. Jewish. Shana Tovah.